This is WJBC This Week.
It wasn't exactly classic Trump, although the substance of what he said tasted a lot like the Trump we've seen. It just didn't have all the calories, so I'm going to call him Trump White.
They were all pretty much in agreement that it's the worst they'd seen around here in a long time.
Illinois could become the second largest win state in the country.
Snubbed, sure. But, you know, I live to fight another day.
All of a sudden, we're dividing people.
It really hasn't been a big issue.
It's a big surprise for me. It's a pleasure, a pleasant surprise.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, a contingent from Illinois State University attends the Republican National Convention. A group that pushed for a nonpartisan way to draw legislative maps in Illinois considers its next move after losing a court battle. A Bloomington business owner is looking to spread his tribute to police throughout the community. A writer for the original Match Game offers an assessment of the current version of the TV game show. The most decorated gymnast in U.S. history, Shannon Miller, visits Bloomington Normal this week. Plus, Illinois Wesleyan remembers one of its legends. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. For the first time since 1970, students from Illinois State University are attending both the Republican National Convention and the Democratic National Convention. WJBC's Terry James talked with politics and government professor Tom McClure after the Republican convention wrapped up in Cleveland this week.
What was your take on that last night? And just from looking around at your students and the crowd, how do you think it went?
Well, I think that it went very well for the people who were here. I was very surprised at the manner of candidate Trump. He seemed somewhat muted as to what we've seen over the last year during the campaign. So it wasn't exactly classic Trump, although the substance of what he said tasted a lot like the Trump we've seen. It just didn't have all the calories, so I'm going to call him Trump Light. I think that's the way he presented himself in terms of his presentation last night.
Yeah, as a professor of politics and government, do we usually see this at the convention level where the candidate is trying to turn in? Because to everyone, he knows he's speaking to Democrats as well as Republicans and those that are undecided.
There's no question that the candidate tries to become more mainstream, but I don't think he really deviated a whole lot from the positions that he's taken. It's just basically his tone, not the substance of what he said.
And that's really what Republican leaders had been asking of him, is tone it down. And a lot of people have been saying that throughout the campaign, is, okay, we know you're passionate about these things, but you got to be a little bit politically correct at least, right?
Well, as a matter of fact, I think he said he denounced political correctness during the speech.
Yeah, he did. I know he did. But it seems that when Donald Trump is on a teleprompter with some pre-thought-out and pre-written comments, he seems to do better with the public. It's such a unique experience to have six students gather along with you. Are they as into this campaign as you would hope for someone of their age to be?
Oh, they were very interested and engaged in what we did. And we had a wide variety of students. We had students ranging from the president of the College Republicans to a student who is a Democrat who works in Senator Durbin's office attend this trip. So we had from one extreme to the other.
Yeah,
everyone
absolutely
was engaged.
During the convention, I just don't know how this whole thing works. I mean, do they only do speeches for certain hours of the day? And could you go in there at 8 a.m. and start hearing speeches until midnight? Is that how it works?
No, there's specific sessions. There was a basically procedural business that was done in the session one on the first day, and that started about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And then at prime time for all 4 days, they had sessions beginning around 7 o'clock at night Eastern time, and that's when the speeches took place. So during the day, there really weren't speeches.
And again, as a professor of politics and government, do you think the candidate Donald Trump did what he needed to at least maybe gain some more respect from people in his own party and bring some of the party to his side?
I think that he certainly offered an olive branch to a number of different constituencies that he needs. The vice presidential candidate selection certainly was something that was done with the evangelicals in mind, also to help party leaders find him more palatable. And that certainly happened. It came together, this convention, with both Speaker Ryan and Senate President Mitch McConnell endorsing Trump. So I think that he accomplished it there. I think he also invited Sanders people to join him. I don't know how effective that would be, but the polling that I've seen shows that about 20% of Sanders people will probably vote for Trump as opposed to Clinton.
Anything that surprised you? You know, it was an odd week. I guess a lot of people are calling it the unconventional convention, from the plagiarism scandal to Trump's kids speaking and the Ted Cruz moment. This was one for the history books, isn't it?
Well, I think part of it is because you've got someone who is more of a showman than a politician when he came into this. So you see a lot of things that you might see in the entertainment world. So, for instance, when he made his first public appearance at the convention, he appeared in a cloud of fog with Queen music in the background. That almost looked like a reality show. The house band was led by G.E. Smith. I don't know whether you remember him.
From Saturday Night Live.
That's right. So he was there. So that gave almost like a late-night talk feel to it, because the band would entertain between speeches. And so you had that. Plus you had the drama of the Ted Cruz non-endorsement and the reaction, and quite frankly, it seemed like an overreaction of the convention delegates to Cruz's non-endorsement. And then on a more somber note, you had the families who had lost loved ones to illegal aliens who testified. So that was certainly a true drama. So you had a lot of the elements of that. And I think that made for a completely different kind of tone or atmosphere to a political convention.
Do you think it was appropriate how anti-Hillary this was compared to pro-Trump, since it was his convention?
I think that's the best thing that Trump has going for him. I think that the strongest asset that Trump has is the fact that he's running against Hillary Clinton. I think that that if there's anything that's going to unify the voters for Trump, will be Hillary Clinton.
That was ISU Politics and Government Professor Tom McClure with Terry James. The recent shootings of police officers in Dallas and Baton Rouge have prompted a national movement to show support for the men and women in blue. It's an effort that a local businessman has adopted. Roy Rapps, as he prefers to be called, owns Central Image Printing, which provides vehicle wraps. He's willing to wrap your car with a blue stripe to show support for the city's finest. And Roy talked with WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
Right now, you have been in the midst of a giant project that has serviced over 2,000 cars in central Illinois, and you're not taking a dime for it. Tell me about these blue lines on the back windshields.
Sure. So the blue lines are just a representation of your support for law enforcement. They're about 1 inch thick, and they go across your back window. And then whoever's driving around can see that you support your local law enforcement officers.
Is this a concept of rally that was created here, or did this happen in another city and you picked up on the trend?
We kind of picked it up last September when the Ferguson riots were happening.
Okay.
We noticed that nobody was supporting the police, but they were certainly supporting a whole bunch of other movements.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of took it upon ourselves to just start giving away the thin blue line.
And when you gave them away, were people installing them themselves, or were you inviting them down to your company and say, hey, we'll put this on for you?
Sure. The majority of the people have come down to our shop,
mm-hmm.
And we're certainly happy to throw them right on for you. It takes a couple of seconds, and you're in and out the door.
And because you're doing it absolutely for free, I have to ask, Roy, has this been costing your company a lot of money, or is it an inexpensive item?
The sticker itself is super cheap. They cost about 7 cents a piece, so we can afford to give that away, certainly. The labor to put it on is certainly a cost. But we'll eat that for something like this.
Well, your hashtag #BackTheBlue started to take off on social media, and that's where I first saw details about these blue lines showing up here in central Illinois. And it turns out a lot of people wanted to say thank you for your donation so they could adorn their vehicle with a support line and started to offer money. And you weren't ready for the money. You weren't trying to ask for money, but you've decided to now take that money for a charity organization.
Yes, ma'am. This kind of grew a little bigger than we expected it to. And so to keep, how do I say this? To keep legal. In line with the legal stuff, right?
And the tax man.
Right. The IRS cometh. So we've since consulted an attorney, mm-hmm. and we're in the process of setting up a 501(c) so that we can accept your money and then turn around and donate that to the families of injured and fallen police officers.
And that movement is also going to be called Back the Blue.
Yes, ma'am. There's a Facebook page set up called Back the Blue hyphen not-for-profit.
Mm-hmm.
You're welcome to go to that page and see where we're going to be next.
Can you make donations on that page as of now or not yet?
No, ma'am. I have to wait until the 501(c) is approved before we can actually start accepting donations.
Fair enough. It's still a very lovely idea. And in the meantime, even in this ungodly heat and humidity, you're going to be out tonight in Fairbury applying blue lines to people who would like them for free. Where and when is that going to happen?
Yes, ma'am. We'll be at the City Hall in Fairbury, Illinois, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. tonight, installing blue lines. Anybody that wants to come out, feel free to show up. They're cooking brats. They're hanging out. You can sit and cajole with your neighbors and hang out put the lives on.
It's one of the great things about summer is getting to see the people that maybe you've missed all winter when you were hanging out inside.
Right, absolutely.
And getting to say hello. What have you heard from police officers that have seen your contributions? What do they say about this effort?
Most of them are super excited that there are people out there to support them. It's tough when they go out and do a job all day like that and don't get any support. So the ability for them to do what they do, which is drive around the majority of the day and see those blue lines on people's vehicles, really lets them know that there are people out there who are still behind them.
Do you have any police officers in your family or circle of trust?
I have several, yes, ma'am.
Does your company end up doing work for police and other law enforcement vehicles? I didn't know if the wraps of the vehicles is how it works.
No, ma'am. We've only been in town 2 years.
Okay.
And the police departments here in town locally already have contracted that out with someone.
Okay.
But we're certainly happy to help them out if they need help.
Just wanted to answer the question because I think what you're doing is lovely. And so that's why a lot of people may scratch their head and go, what's in it for them? And I would guess the what's in it for you is a feeling of pride, a feeling of community, thanking those officers for what they're doing. But if anybody stops by your shop, they might also go, ooh, look what I could do. And I
right,
hadn't thought
certainly.
About that.
I don't think it really started out that way. I think it started out that we were really upset that people were selling these is where it really started.
Uh-huh.
We noticed online that they were going for $8 and $10 a piece, and I don't really think it's fair that someone would capitalize on something like this.
And you knew they were 7 cents.
Right,
so.
They're super cheap. You know, so
okay, now let's cut to the chase here. Roy, if I put one of these on the back of my vehicle, do you think I'm less likely to get pulled over for being a speeder?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
I think the police have a job to do, and most of them do it pretty well.
That was Roy Rapps from Central Image Printing with Susan Saunders. The Match Game Show has had several incarnations in its television history, going back more than 50 years, most recently coming back on ABC with Alec Baldwin as host. Dick DiBartolo is known now as the Giz Whiz on ABC's World News Now, but many years ago, he was a writer for the original version of The Match Game. DiBartolo talked with WJBC's Scott Laughlin this week.
When I saw that The Match Game was back and I watched an episode, I just loved it. And I thought, hey, wait a minute, we had Dick DiBartolo on, one of the original writers for The Match Game. And my producer is so young, she thought The Match Game was like a dating game type thing. She had no idea.
She knows now it's not.
All right. Now, help me here. Were you writing filthy jokes?
You know what? We were writing.
Double entendre.
Yes, exactly. And I think the difference is back then, you wrote things that sort of hinted at what you were thinking. And now, to my mind, it takes some of the fun out of it because they just write the answers.
Yeah.
I've seen more stuff on network television than I can't repeat on radio that I can't even repeat to my family.
I know. So how did you get involved with Match Game? What were you doing at the time?
You know what? I was working for Mad Magazine, and a friend of mine was working for Goodson Todman. And I said, you know, we have this show, and it needs questions. And he said, well, come over and talk to us. So I did. And actually, the original Match Game was the questions were very different. They were straight questions like name a president who appears on Money, name something you can do with an egg. And I wrote thousands of them. And it was a year contract. And at 10 months in, Goodson called me and he said, listen, the show's canceled. And I'm just giving you a heads up. I know you have 2 months of shows to do, but it's not going forward. And then over the weekend, I thought about it. And on Monday, I said, you know, Mark, I work for Mad. I write a lot of silly stuff. So instead of name a red flower, how about Mary liked to pour gravy on John's blank? And Goodson laughed and he said, oh, that's so funny. But what will they say? I said, Mark, they'll laugh and then they'll say mashed potatoes, roast beef, but all the time they'll be laughing because they're thinking otherwise.
Right.
And he said, look, it's canceled. They can cancel it twice. So do what you want.
So wait a minute. Then would you get creator credit for that? Because, I mean, that's a whole different ball game from the original Match Game.
I was editorial consultant. I wish if I had gotten like 1% of royalties after the yes, and then a month later he called me in and he said, you know, people love those new questions and so does NBC and they pick it up for another year. So in various forms at Goodson, it ran on and off for 18 years. And then when Goodson passed on, it sold to Fremantle. And I assume, I'm not even sure if Fremantle's doing the current version or another company. But yeah, had I not worked for Mad, had I not thought of those weird things, there would be no Match Game.
So have you seen some of the newer episodes?
Yes, I watched the first one, and I thought it was a little over the top. I think Alex is doing a good job. But you know what? When you work – I worked with Gene for so many years.
Gene Rayburn.
Gene Rayburn and Charles Nelson Reilly and Brett Summers. And there was just a chemistry there that I personally don't feel in the new show, but people who don't know the old show probably feel totally different about the new Mets.
I'm wondering, I'll be honest, do you feel that the questions aren't as creative and they don't have to be as creative?
You know what? I think the questions are just written to get those dirty answers.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had to be a little crazier writing them. And you know, when I've told the story before, we used to throw in three or four. You know, back then there was a thing called standards and practices.
They don't have that anymore.
No, they don't have that anymore.
We have no standards here either. So
no, you see, yeah. So that's why I like doing this show. And so you would throw in three questions that would just lewd, so that when they read those, they would go, "Are those guys crazy?"
Yeah.
And then they would say, "Oh, this one's not so bad." So anyway, I prefer the original Match Game, but the current one's doing okay.
That was Dick DiBartolo, the Gizwiz, with Scott Laughlin. The most decorated gymnast in U.S. history was in Bloomington Normal this week. Shannon Miller signed autographs for fans before Normal Corn Belters game at the Corn Crib, a game that was postponed by rain. Miller looked back at her Olympic past and how her foundation is combating childhood obesity, as she talked with WJVC's Zach Zook this week.
Explain to me what it's like having a defining moment such as being in the Olympics like that. What's that like for you?
You know, it was absolutely incredible. And to think that it was 20 years ago, in the summer of 1996, when we won gold for the first time, is absolutely incredible. But for me, I think, you know, the memories of standing up there on that podium, gold medal, but more so seeing the American flag being raised and hearing the sound of your national anthem, especially on home soil, is such a dream come true for all of us.
And you are one of the most decorated gymnasts in American history, which is truly an accomplishment to be proud of. But that was really just, I mean, the start of what you've been able to do. You have started up a women's health company. Do you want to tell me a little bit more about that?
Sure. Yeah, in 20 years, it's been kind of a whirlwind. I finished up with my undergraduate education, law school, and then I started my company devoted to women's health. And we focus on helping women make their health a priority, and that encompasses everything from fitness and nutrition to sleep and stress management to cancer awareness, diabetes, heart disease, all those things that women need to think about with their health.
And you've also started the foundation. Now, did this foundation come first, or did the company come first? I'm assuming one spurred off of the other.
I'm really an advocate for both women's and children's health. I started the foundation a couple years before my company, and the foundation is devoted to fighting childhood obesity. And the primary goal is really to get kids active, get them to understand and to see their love of physical activity, because we are made to move. Kids love to move if given that opportunity. So we do our best to reduce barriers to physical activity. And right now we support over 8,000 children in the Jacksonville area.
And so your corporation or foundation, if you will, is founded in Florida. Do you have any aspirations to broaden the spectrum, I guess, so to speak?
Well, the company is national, it will even international in scope with regard to women's health. With regard to my foundation and the childhood obesity, I personally do a lot nationwide with regard to health, nutrition, fitness with children, but the actual 501c3, the actual foundation is in Jacksonville. And right now, I think we're going to have to keep it local. I'm not sure I can handle too much more. I've got a lot of things going.
So you think you'd like to stay local then, I guess, for the time being, or is it something that you would consider if it came up?
Well, right now, as far as my personal foundation, the 501c3, we're local, but I do personally a lot of things nationally with other. We partner all the time with other organizations. I personally partner with a lot of different organizations to get kids active and thinking about nutrition, and that really goes hand in hand with talking to parents about their nutrition, because we're really the ones that set the example for our children. If I'm sitting on the couch eating potato chips, well, that's what my kids want to do. But if I'm out playing tag in the yard, if I'm out doing things, well, then that's what they want to do.
Well, that's awesome to hear. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, what are we thinking about Rio this summer? Do you think they're going to have a great team?
I was out at Olympic Trials a couple weeks ago, and the team looks amazing. This is probably one of the best teams that we've ever had in the history of the sport. So I'm incredibly hopeful. I don't think we're going to have any issue walking home with gold for the team. I say we like I have any part of it. they will be walking home with gold for the team. And then I think some other medals, of course, for the all-around and the event finals. I think it's going to be a tremendous run for women's gymnastics, and I think that men's gymnastics has every opportunity to get on the medal podium this year.
That was Olympic medalist Shannon Miller with Zach Zook. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. A judge has ruled that a voter referendum seeking to change the way Illinois draws its political boundaries is unconstitutional for the November ballot. It's the second time that such an attempt has been blocked in the courts. In both instances, a lawsuit brought by an attorney linked to top Democrats argued that it didn't meet constitutional muster. The chairman of the group that's leading the redistricting effort, Dennis Fitzsimons, of the Independent Map Amendment, talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
Sir, where do you go from here?
Well, first of all, from the beginning of our campaign, we expected that the constitutionality of the Independent Map Amendment would be challenged. And also, we expected the legal fight to end up in front of the Supreme Court. So this was really just round one. And in the ruling, the court confirmed that our position that redistricting in general is a structural and procedural subject of the Illinois Constitution and therefore fair game for a citizen initiative, but then the court delivered an interpretation basically that would make it virtually impossible to empower a citizen commission, given the court's hyper-limited restrictions on what a citizen initiative can do to ensure a truly independent redistricting process. So we will immediately appeal to the Supreme Court, and that is our plan. We expected it one way or the other in terms of how this ruling went in the circuit court, that it would go up to the Supreme Court. But, you know, the what's really interesting about this is the kind of interpretation that the court came down with is contrary to the intent of the writers of the Illinois Constitution, because they specifically envisioned a citizen-led process that could make changes to the redistricting process, because they said at the time legislators would be reluctant to do so. So, again, we filed an immediate notice of appeal, and we'll be asking the Supreme Court to take up this issue on an expedited basis.
Now, this is on, the independent map amendment, and the expectation is to have this on the ballot in November. Now, if the Illinois State Supreme Court says okay, let's rewind just a minute and explain to folks why you are pushing for this amendment.
Well, right now we have, in November, over 60% of state legislative races will be uncontested. And a big reason for this is that the maps, that is the state legislative maps, are drawn in secret to protect incumbents and maximize the advantage of the party drawing the maps. So consequently, candidates from opposing parties don't think they can win, so they don't run. So this gives more power to the party leaders who draw the maps and takes away power from the voters in the districts. Given the situation that Illinois is ranked 50 out of 50 states in citizen confidence in state government, we're last in pension debt per capita in terms of having the most pension debt per capita. There's a general perception that there's corruption in state government. So with all these things, only one incumbent lost in November of 2014 in over 100 races. So we've got this situation that is creating voter cynicism because they think their votes don't count. They have all these problems that are going on in our state, yet they go to the polls and they only have one candidate to vote for. So this is what we're trying to change by having the legislative maps drawn by an independent commission that would be drawn in a public, a transparent and fair manner with no partisan intent. So this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to give Illinois citizens more of a voice in their government and a chance to have multiple candidates that will be more accountable to the voters in their districts than they are to the party leaders.
The way I understand it is that the Illinois Speaker of the House, Democrat Michael Madigan, is very opposed to this. Do you think there were any partisan politics at play bringing this to the courts and hoping that it would lose on the part of Michael Madigan?
I really can't comment on that. And what I like to, and I have said since the beginning of this campaign, is this campaign is not aimed at any one individual or one party. It's aimed at changing a process that hasn't worked as it was designed to work. And the whole idea is to give power back to voters as opposed to party leaders. Clearly, this is not something that many legislators want to change, even though we have endorsements from legislators on both sides of the aisle. Clearly, the leadership does not want this to change, and the nominal challenger to the constitutionality of this amendment is a group called the People's Map, and they have shown no contributions or expenditures in the year that they've been in existence. So it makes you wonder, where is the funding coming from for this very expensive litigation to try to strike down our amendment?
That was Dennis Fitzsimons of the Independent Map Amendment with Terry James. And one of the legends of Illinois Wesleyan athletics got very little media attention, Ed Alsine was generating coverage for the athletes and coaches with whom he worked for nearly a quarter century, and that came after a distinguished career as a sports reporter. Alsine died this week, 8 months after the university named its Sports Information Department in his honor. Retired athletic director Denny Bridges looked back on Alsine's legacy at Illinois Wesleyan as he talked with WJBC this week. Denny, just to reflect on your time in working with Ed.
I came to Illinois Wesleyan in 1964, and I think Edgar came in 1965 or 66, soon after. He was our sports information director. He was the first sports information director we had, and gosh, it just took so much of the pressure off us coaches as far as statistics and dealing with the media and making sure that we treated WJBC and the Pantograph the same. He just was a wonderful, wonderful guy to have work with, and he was a good friend. Actually, we were neighbors. He lived across the street from us for lots of years.
That's interesting. And I guess going back to when he came on board in the 1960s, it sounded like there was no such thing as an SID or athletic department spokesperson, and you had to handle that all yourself, or the coaches did.
It was. It was a big difference to Don Larson and Coach Hornberger and Bob Kick, because they had been coaches for a number of years without that perk, and I, of course, hadn't. I'd been a high school coach and had just come on board, so I didn't know what. In the beginning, I didn't realize what a big upgrade it was to have Edgar come on board. You know, often over the years, the Titan athletes of that generation talked about how the four of us, how Coach Hornberger, Coach Larson, Coach Keck, and I did it all. We mowed the fields. We did the laundry. We taught the classes. We did the recruiting. We did the stats. Well, what happened was there really weren't four of us. There were five of us. When Edgar came on board, he was the fifth man. And I think if Don Larson or Bob Keck were here today, or Coach Hornberger to talk to you, they would say it was a huge plus. And even though Edgar graduated from ISU, which we gigged him about a lot, he was a Titan. And he grew up in the city, had been at the Pantograph for a number of years, and actually the newspaper business had taken him to Iowa, and he came back, and he just made us a much more professional organization. And at that time, I don't know whether the Augustanas and the Millikens and the other schools had SIDs, but boy, it was really great that we did.
Well, and of course, he carried that tradition on for a couple of decades, eventually handed that off to Stu Salowitz, who is still in that position today, some nearly 30 years later.
Yeah, and you know, it's important. Edgar was important to us, and now Stu is important to us, because the thing that both of them did brought a sense of history. They knew who Fred Young was. Now they know Stu knows who Jack Hornberger was and Don Larson was. And when we lose Stu and go to a Tech or a young guy who's really good electronically, we'll probably lose a whole lot of the connection to the past.
Well, and of course, Ed was that link to the past for many years and was a huge Titan supporter long after his retirement, up until as recently as maybe a year ago. I recall, in fact, 2 years ago, there was a reception for him at Shirk Center to mark his 90th birthday. And he was still very much alert and very much engaged in what was going on, although things certainly slipped over time.
That's right. They also named the SID's office in his honor and had a ceremony for him. And it's amazing the number of athletes, the guys that were on the teams who appreciated and recognized what Edgar had done for them, who came back. I know that Edgar was a prime mover in the Academic All-American program, in on the ground floor. Early, the national committees, Edgar was involved, and that got us off to such a great start getting Academic All-Americans. And I know that Jack Sikma was a Academic All-American Hall of Famer, and he credits Ed Alsine for making that happen, and it was a big deal.
I guess I'll share a story while we're doing this. I was at a North Park basketball game covering Illinois Wesleyan, I'd say about 4 or 5 years ago, and Wayne Messmer was there to perform the national anthem. I had not met Wayne before, and Ed comes up to me and says, "Do you know who that is?" And told me he was Wayne Messmer. He was performing the national anthem, and he was offering to go and set up an interview for it. This was 4 or 5 years ago. He'd been retired for 20 years, but still thinking about how he could serve others. And that just, I found pretty phenomenal.
It was. Edgar was a lifelong Titan, and we coaches appreciated it, and the players appreciated it, and I'm sure people in the media, because like guys like you knew that you were dealing with a professional.
Absolutely. Well, there's if there was a short list of the most influential and most respected Titans in athletics, he would certainly be on it, even though he may not have as much notoriety as yourself, Jack Hornberger, Don Larson, and the others.
That's right, and that's why I'm really happy that you called, because there are a lot of old-time Titans out there that listen to WJBC, and I would like to have them know how important he was. A couple of sad things is that Edgar was the world's greatest Cub fan. I mean, he lived and died and loved the Cubs. And now this year, the Cubs are on their way maybe to having their first World Series, and we lose Edgar. The other thing Edgar was in town was an avid golfer. I mean, he had a gang, some that played out at Highland Park, and he was my partner against Coach Larson and Coach Keck, and we had some epic battles. So golf was a big part of his life.
That was retired Illinois Wesleyan Athletic Director Denny Bridges reflecting on the life of Ed Alsine this week. The Week in News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Week in News. The reconstruction of Rab Road near Normal Community High School is now unlikely to finish before mid-September. That's what town engineer Gene Brown told the town council this week as the council approved $300,000 more dollars for the project to help fix a wet soil problem. Brown says this is the worst wet soil issue he's ever seen.
We've had three materials engineers from IDOT involved in this. Their Bureau of Construction engineer, two or three of our consultants from the design group, also our geotechnical consultant, and they were all pretty much in agreement that it's the worst they'd seen around here in a long time.
City Manager Mark Peterson says since the project won't be finished before school begins, they're in contact with Unit 5 to see what the town can do to alleviate any traffic problems. A father and son are facing charges related to an alleged sexual assault of a woman on the Illinois State University campus during the school's freshman preview week. 19-year-old Sean Childs Jr. of Chicago allegedly assaulted the woman in a residence hall on Tuesday night after his father, Sean Childs Sr., allegedly put a drug in the woman's drink. Students and parents stay in dorm rooms on separate floors during the preview week. Childs Jr. is being charged with criminal sexual assault, while Childs Sr. faces drug charges. A study of the 25 largest wind farms in Illinois by Illinois State University's Center for Renewable Energy says wind farms have supported more than 20,000 jobs during their construction. Center Director David Loomis says that's in addition to the $6.4 billion the farms will add to the economy through their 25-year lifespan.
According to the U.S. Department of Energy, Illinois could become the second largest wind state in the country behind Texas by 2050.
McLean County produces 15% of the state's wind energy, which is first in the state. And McLean County will do more to notify the public of proposed new wind farm regulations after a county board member claimed hardly anyone knew about them.
The legal requirement may have been met, but the lack of information to the public, especially those impacted residents, is unacceptable.
County board member Catherine Metzger says the county should do more than publish a notice in the paper and notify county board members. The county plans a second Zoning Board of Appeals hearing in September and will put the notice in multiple papers and notify all local governments in the county. Metzger backed off her call for more restrictive setbacks and decommissioning for wind farms, Proposals the county building and zoning director, Phil Dick, say would go too far.
I don't understand the reason for it, unless it is to make it so that you really can't put hardly any turbines out there. And that's the problem that we see, is we want to put restrictions on turbines so that it doesn't impact residences.
The ZBA will consider new rules that the McLean County Farm Bureau has proposed. And party line votes rarely happen during McLean County board meetings, but it happened this week as the board handed out committee assignments. Democrat Eric Rankin hoped to be elevated from his vice chairman seat on the Finance Committee of the Republican-controlled board when Republican Ben Owens resigned, but Republican Jim Soldner got the seat instead.
Snubbed, sure. But, you know, I live to fight another day. I still have a lot of really good committee assignments.
Board Chairman John McIntyre recommended the assignments. He notes the leadership posts are proportional to board membership.
We have traditionally had, over the years, I would say leadership in roles that reflects the majority and minority in a fair way.
Republicans outnumber Democrats on the board 14-6. And the town of Normal has named Mandava Rao its Citizen of the Year. Mayor Chris Koo says to say Rao is active in the community is an understatement.
He has founded and helps to lead numerous organizations, including the Central Illinois Cricket Association, For a Better Tomorrow, and the local chapter of the SCWA, a group guided by the principle of service beyond self.
Rao said he had no idea the honor was coming.
It's a big surprise for me. It's a pleasure, pleasant surprise.
Rao moved to Bloomington Normal from India 16 years ago. He says he stayed here because he fell in love with the community. Up next, the week to come. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, Bloomington's City Council will consider providing support for the Criterium bicycle race that's coming to downtown next month. On Tuesday, we will get an economic outlook for McLean County from Ed Charlow of Busey Bank and their 18th annual breakfast scheduled at Illinois Wesleyan. Also Tuesday, United Way of McLean County will present a check to Habitat for Humanity's Women Build that it raised through its Power of the Purse event. Also Tuesday, the Illinois Farm Bureau in Bloomington will open a 50-year-old time capsule and dedicate a new time capsule. And our Terry James will broadcast live from the Woodford County Fair in Eureka on Tuesday. And on Saturday, WJBC will once again take part in the annual St. Jude Run from Bloomington to Peoria, as the community raises money for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.